Well, good evening, brothers and sisters. It's a long time ago now, but in the last study, you may remember that we considered Nehemiah chapters 3 and 4, chapters which describe the rebuilding of the city walls. The construction work was challenging enough, but at the same time, Nehemiah and his colleagues had to deal with violent threats from the Samaritan opposition. But such was the effectiveness of Nehemiah's organisation of the Jews, both as builders and as soldiers, the work progressed with few delays. But the problems of rebuilding a broken wall and resisting an opposing army were not to be the only challenges that Nehemiah had to deal with. So tonight we look at Nehemiah chapters 5 and 6. In the beginning of chapter 5 we have the first of these problems outlined. Verse 1 reads, "Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews." Well, here was the potential for a real catastrophe. To complete the rebuilding of Jerusalem, it was vital that the nation be united in the common purpose. But that unity was now in danger of fragmenting. The root cause of the trouble was that many of the Jews were experiencing hardship because their economy was in dire trouble. Because of all the effort that was being put into rebuilding the walls and manning the defences, normal economic activity had been severely curtailed. You may remember from Nehemiah chapter 3 that many of the Jews had given up their normal occupation to become builders and soldiers. We read there of goldsmiths, perfumers and merchants working on the wall. But obviously while they were occupied in building, they would earn no wages. But they would still need money to support themselves. In particular, they needed to buy good nourishing food to enable them to continue with the hard physical labour of building the wall. And they had large families to support, so a lot of food was needed. As verse 2 explains, some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." But in addition to the city craftsmen giving up their businesses, some Jews had come up from the country to support the rebuilding work. As a result, they had let their farms to others. And as they were not tending their farms, they also needed to buy food. So verse 3 continues, "Others were saying, 'We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards and our homes to get grain during the famine.'" But the Jews not only had to find money to buy food for themselves, as a subject people, they had to pay tribute to their Persian overlords, as verse 4 explains. Still others were saying, "We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards." Although the Persian tax rate was a relatively modest 20%, it could not be avoided without provoking draconian measures from the might of Persia. The general hardship being experienced by the Jews was bad enough. But what made the situation so divisive was that a few Jews were taking advantage of the situation. As well as forcing their fellow Jews to mortgage their property in order to raise money to buy food, they were charging interest on the loans. Now such practice was expressly forbidden in the law of Moses. In Exodus we read, "If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a moneylender to him. You shall not charge him interest." Well, the problem was exacerbated because, as we read in verse 3, this was a time of famine, so food prices would be inflated. Therefore, the proceeds of their mortgages were soon exhausted, and the only way to raise further funds was for these impoverished Jews to sell their children into slavery. This is what we see in verse 5. "Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." This trend of taking the Jews into slavery was also a breach of God's law. The law laid down what should happen when a man did not have the means to repay a debt, Leviticus tells us that if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner he shall be with you, and shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. Well, that statement couldn't be clearer, could it? It permitted taking a poor Israelite as a hired servant, but prohibited forcing him into slavery. And so the oppressors of Nehemiah chapter 5 were showing complete disregard for this law by forcing the poor into slavery. So it's little wonder that Nehemiah was very angry when he became aware of this situation. As we have noted before, it was those who should have known better that were at the forefront of this abuse. Verses 6 and 7 read, "When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind, and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, 'You are charging your own people interest.' Thus it was the nobles and rulers who should have upheld the law by ensuring that the disadvantaged were protected. It was they who were taking advantage of the situation to line their own pockets." But we wonder whether this failing was partly Nehemiah's responsibility. After all, he was the governor, and hence the supreme judicial authority in the province. But before we criticise, we should perhaps remember two things. Firstly, we know how Nehemiah's consuming interest was the welfare of God's city and people. Perhaps he had a bit of a blind spot as to the way others were behaving, because he expected everyone to share his own idealism and enthusiasm. And secondly, in his role as governor, we remember that he was appointed by the Persian king, and so his responsibility was to ensure the Persian interests were looked after. The commandments that were being ignored were nothing to do with the laws of the Medes and Persians. Rather were they precepts from the law of Moses. And as such, it was the responsibility of the priests to instruct and regulate in those respects. And I think this view is reinforced by the fact that when Nehemiah raises the issue with the nobles, he doesn't impose his authority as governor as the means of stamping out this malpractice. Rather, he appeals to the conscience of the people and reinforces that appeal by his own example. He tells them he had not purchased any of his countrymen as slaves. Rather, had he done the reverse, he had redeemed Jews who were in slavery to foreign owners, as we see from his words recorded in verse 8. "According to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations." And after the Jews agree to put matters right, it is the priests that are given the task of ensuring God's law was implemented to the full. Second half of Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse 12 makes clear that it is they who are given the task of ensuring the restitution of wrongfully acquired land and wealth. "Then I called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to this promise." But the question remains as to whether Nehemiah was entirely without fault in this matter. If you look at verse 10, it states very clearly that Nehemiah was acting as a moneylender. He confesses, "I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please, let us stop this usury." Well, of course, there was nothing wrong with lending money. And the question raised by this verse is whether Nehemiah was one of those who was charging interest. Well, as we have already noted, he had redeemed fellow Jews. And as we shall see in a moment, he was extremely generous in providing free hospitality to many Jews. Such voluntary generosity seems incompatible with charging illegal interest. So I think that when Nehemiah says, "Please let us stop this usury," he was urging all the Jews to be consistent in their approach, to be like him. By all means, lend money, but don't charge interest. The reason this lending and usury was causing such hardship was that the interest rates were quite high, as is indicated in verse 11. There Nehemiah encourages the nobles to restore what they had acquired. "Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves and their houses, also a hundredth of the money, and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you have charged them. The key phrase there is a hundredth of the money. In biblical times, it was apparently the norm to quote interest rates by the month rather than the year. And it is thought that the reference to a hundredth of the money refers to an interest rate of 1% per month. That's pretty close to the current charges made for any uncleared balance on a credit card, so you can see how high the rates were. But we must give the nobles and rulers their due. Although they had been shamed by being called to account before a general assembly of all the people, they seemed to respond willingly and wholeheartedly, as we see from verses 12 and 13. So they said, "We will restore it, and will require nothing from them. We will do as you say." Then the people did according to this promise. And so another crisis was resolved through Nehemiah's decisive intervention, his personal example, and his diplomacy. A few moments ago, we mentioned Nehemiah's generosity, and this is demonstrated in the closing verses of chapter 5. Verse 14, "Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. And at my table, verse 17, were 150 Jews and rulers, besides those who came to us from the nations around." Thus it was that over the 12-year period of his governorship, Nehemiah refused to take advantage of his position, choosing not to accept his rightful dues. Indeed, rather than enjoying the governor's provisions, i.e. food supplied by the people to the governor's kitchen, Nehemiah fed a great number of people from his own resources, and fed them very generously indeed, as we see from verse 18. "Now that which was prepared daily was one ox, six choice sheep, also fowl were prepared for me, and once every 10 days an abundance of all kinds of wine. Yet in spite of this, I did not demand the governor's provisions, because the bondage was heavy on this people." But there is one final important detail that comes from this passage. Nehemiah's generosity was not inspired by just humanitarian ideals. As we see from chapter 5 and verse 15, it was because of the fear of God. And I think this choice of phrase is no coincidence, for it shows Nehemiah to be a student of the Lord. The two problems that were being addressed by the events described in this chapter were the charging of usury and oppression of rulership. In that context, we should note these two verses from Leviticus chapter 25. First of all, verse 36 reads, "Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God." Then verse 43, "You shall not rule over him with rigour, but you shall fear your God." It would seem, therefore, that these verses were in Nehemiah's mind as he decided how he should behave, or he acted as he did because of the fear of God. Well, having dealt with the problem that threatened the unity of the people's resolve to rebuild Jerusalem, Nehemiah continued the work on the wall. But soon a new and quite different challenge was to arise, as we see from chapter 6 and verse 1. "Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall and that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors in the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, 'Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono.' But they thought to do me harm." In order to disrupt the work, the Samaritans had previously tried ridicule and violence. Having failed with both of those approaches, they then turned to intrigue and conspiracy. In the earlier attempts, the Samaritans had targeted the Jews as a whole. Now, recognizing that Nehemiah was the real motivating force behind the work, they single him out as the focus for their project. The villages in the plain of Ono were about midway between Samaria and Jerusalem. That location was probably suggested as a suitable neutral venue for a summit meeting between them. Doubtless the invitation was couched in the finest diplomatic language. We imagine the thrust of the letter was something like, "We've had our differences in the past, but let's now work together for the benefit of both parties." But Nehemiah suspected that the motive for the invitation was less than honourable. Whether as a result of specific intelligence or on the basis that a leopard doesn't change his spots, Nehemiah felt that going to the plains of Ono would result in his assassination or imprisonment. His formal response to the invitation does not mention his suspicions, but in equally diplomatic language, he says that he is too busy with construction work to attend a meeting. Four times Sanballat issues the invitation, and four times the response was the same. "I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you?" Well, interestingly, the diplomatic bag is not a modern development. In those days, official intergovernmental correspondence was sent in a silk bag sealed with the sender's seal of office. Having repeatedly failed with deceitful diplomacy, Sanballat then resorts to blackmail when a fifth letter is sent. This time, the sealed diplomatic bag is not used. Rather, the content of the letter was opened for all to read, as we see from verses 5 to 7. "Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before, the fifth time, with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, 'It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumours, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. And you have also appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, "There is a king in Judah." Now these matters will be reported to the king. So come, therefore, and let us consult together." This accusation that they had made of a planned rebellion was, of course, not new. When the Jews had first declared their intention to rise up and build, Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah and Geshem laughed at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?" That accusation was originally said in mockery, but now the walls have been rebuilt. All that remained was to hang the new gates. The situation was very different. The city was once again a fortress, and an accusation of planned rebellion was much more credible. So the intent of this open letter for all to read was to discredit Nehemiah in the eyes of the Persian authorities and to sow doubts in the minds of the Jews. But to carry any weight, this accusation would need to be substantiated in some way. We are not told what evidence Sanballat produced, but I think the clue is in that extra detail in Sanballat's open letter. If you look at verse 7, we see there that he accused Nehemiah of appointing prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, "There is a king in Judah." Now look at verse 14, where Nehemiah links his accusers with a group of prophets who had tried to frighten him. "My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these their works, and the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets, who would have made me afraid." Well, how would these false prophets under the pay of Sanballat provoke fear in the governor? Well, as we well know, the Jewish scriptures often speak of the Messiah, the one who would restore the fortunes of Jerusalem. Perhaps it was that Noadiah and the other false prophets were misapplying the scriptures to assert that Nehemiah was claiming to be that long-promised saviour of his people. Listen to how these words from Isaiah chapter 62 might sound in the mouth of someone who was trying to frame Nehemiah. "For Zion's sake I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest. for Nehemiah had certainly devoted all his energy to the welfare of the city. Isaiah continues, "I have set watchmen on your walls, O Jerusalem. They shall never hold their peace, day or night." Nehemiah had certainly done just that too. And Isaiah continues, "Surely I will no longer give your grains food for your enemies, and the sons of the foreigner shall not drink your new wine, for which you have laboured, but those who have gathered it shall eat it." That was just one of the problems that Nehemiah had sorted out only a few days before. Isaiah 62 then continues, go through the gates, prepare the way for the people, build up the highway, take out the stones. Nehemiah was just commencing that very task of repairing the gates and doubtless improving the roads that led in and out of the city. Well, in those quotes from Isaiah that I've just read to you, I have not changed a single word. I've just been very selective in the phrases I've chosen to read. The point I'm trying to make is that you can see how easy it would be for words like those to be misapplied. You can see how Sanballat would use them as evidence that Nehemiah was setting himself up as king with the intention of throwing off the Persian yoke. In the accusation, Sanballat might refer to other words from that same chapter in Isaiah as a description of Nehemiah's alleged ambitions. "The Gentiles shall see your righteousness, and all kings your glory. You shall also be a crown of glory and a royal diadem." This new accusation, therefore, was an altogether more serious and potentially damaging threat. Here was evidence, albeit distorted by the false prophets, to substantiate the accusation of rebellion. Indeed, it seems that a letter had already gone to the Persian court. For in verse 6 of chapter 6 we read, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says, the Jew and the Jews plan to rebel." If you look at the marginal notes in your Bible, you probably see that the original text attributes Gashmu rather than Geshem as the name of the person who was the source of these rumours. Now Gashmu is the Chaldean form of the name, and it would be the way he would sign a letter sent to the imperial court at Shushan. So a letter had already gone. And the Jews might be able to resist an attack from the Samaritans, but there's no way they could hold off the might of the Persian military machine. The accusations and the witness of the false prophets were intended to make the Jews anxious about retribution from Persia, and as a result, to give up the rebuilding work. As Nehemiah says in verse 9, "For they all were trying to make us afraid, saying, their hands will be weakened in the work, and it will not be done." Doubtless this open letter was reinforced by verbal threats spoken to those manning the wall's defences. Like the servants of Sennacherib of an earlier time, they called out with a loud voice in Hebrew to the people of Jerusalem who were on the wall, to frighten them and trouble them, that they might take the city. On that occasion, Hezekiah's response was to pray and cry out to heaven. As an equally faithful servant of God, Nehemiah's reaction was just the same. And we are given another of his short but impassioned prayers at the end of verse 9. "Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands." That prayer was answered, for as we shall see in a moment, the work continued and the task was finished. But Sanballat still did not give up his scheming. If he could not get Nehemiah to leave Jerusalem by subtlety or by threat, he could get his contacts in Jerusalem to do the dirty work for him. So we come to verse 10 of chapter 6. Reading from the NIV, "One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, 'Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you.'" Well, we wonder why Nehemiah came to Shemaiah's house. Normally, surely it would be the other way round. a citizen would seek an audience with the governor at his palace, or given Nehemiah's commitment to the work, would seek him out at some place on the wall where he was directing operations. But we are specifically told that Nehemiah comes to Shemaiah's house. And the reason is, we are told in verse 10, he, Shemaiah, was shut in at his home. If you happen to be using the New King James, you will note that this phrase, shut in at his home, is translated as, he was a secret informer. But the Hebrew word is used in all other places with a sense of shut up or restrained. So I think that on this occasion, the New King James rendering is doubtful. So if Shemaiah was shut up in his home, what was the reason? Well, perhaps he was under house arrest, for the very same phrase is used in Jeremiah 36 to describe Jeremiah's imprisonment when he was shut up in the court of the prison. And as verse 12 indicates, Nehemiah had already identified Shemaiah as one of the prophets that Sanballat had hired along with Noadiah, and had therefore placed him under house arrest. However, that seems unlikely, for if he had already been rumbled, there would be no credibility in Shemaiah's suggestion that Nehemiah seek refuge in the temple to escape these Samaritan assassins. So is there another reason why Shemaiah was shut up in his house? Well, we note that Shemaiah proposes that they both go to the temple. And that means that he must have been free to go there too. So maybe Shemaiah's home was in the temple precincts. We say this because we are told that he was a descendant of Deliah, and Deliah was head of one of the 24 priestly courses, as we see from 1 Chronicles 24. So if he was the priest on duty, that would tie him to the temple for the duration of his period of service. Nehemiah would recognise that responsibility, so we come to see Shemaiah rather than expecting the priest to come and find him. It would also explain why Nehemiah would respond to an invitation for a meeting, for the civil governor and the duty priest would surely often have the need to meet. Whatever prompted the visit, Nehemiah's suspicions were quickly aroused. Shemaiah had tried to frighten Nehemiah into a foolish action. He had said, "Let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you." Notice the repetition in the description of the venue. It was in the house of God, within the temple. So the proposed venue for the meeting was not some outer precinct, but in the sanctuary itself. The reference to closing the doors of the temple probably means that Shemaiah was proposing that they met in the holy place itself. But in making such a suggestion, Shemaiah surely overplayed his hand, for it immediately aroused Nehemiah's suspicions. He would know that only the priests were allowed entry to that place. Far from being a means of saving Nehemiah's life from assassins, entering the holy place would mean his life was forfeit. For as God had said when appointing the Levites, "I give your priesthood to you as a gift for service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death." So Nehemiah's response to Shemaiah's suggestion was prompt and forthright. "Should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Nehemiah, we know, believed in the power of prayer. He had asked for God to strengthen his hands. Now he drew on that strength, accepting his responsibility as the governor to lead from the front. He would not hide away in some secure and protected place. But I think there may be something more in this rejection of Shemaiah's suggestion, for there is a twofold aspect to Nehemiah's rejection of the proposal. Firstly, he says, "Should such a man as I flee?" As a believer in the protecting hand of the God of heaven, he would not hide away. But then he continues, "And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life?" Was this just repetition? Or was he stating a second reason why he could not enter the temple? Well, in his service as cupbearer in the Persian court, we know how Nehemiah served both king and queen. Those officers of the court with access to the queen would always be eunuchs. And so it is likely that Nehemiah too was a eunuch, and this would be a second reason why he could not enter God's house. The proposed venue for this meeting was in breach of the law on two counts, and because it came from a priest who should have known better, Nehemiah's suspicions were aroused. And thus, verse 12, Nehemiah perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me, because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid, and act that way in sin, so they might have cause for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Thus the intended smear campaign failed before it gathered any traction. The conspiracy had failed. And so the work continues without disruption. As verse 15 tells us, the wall was finished in the remarkably short time of 52 days. All through that period, the Samaritans have been ridiculing and threatening the Jews in the hope of discouraging the work. And how the writer of this book of Nehemiah must have found satisfaction as he penned the words of Nehemiah 6 and verse 16. And it happened when all our enemies heard of it, that is, the completion of the wall, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. The enemies of the Jews had failed in their disruptive scheming and had become disheartened by the outcome. In marked contrast, the Jews had succeeded with their ambitious plan, and as we shall see later, rejoiced greatly. But although the rebuilding work was complete, the Jews still had to remain vigilant, as we see from the opening of chapter 7. It opens with an apparent transfer of power, as Nehemiah hands responsibility for the city to his brother Hanani. Then it was, when the wall was built, and I had hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers and the Levites had been appointed, that I gave the charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hanani, and Hanani, the leader of the citadel, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Does this transfer of power indicate that it was at this point that Nehemiah returned to the Persian court? Certainly the work he sought permission to accomplish had been completed, and it would seem a natural point in time for him to return to the king in fulfilment of his promise. If this is so, it has to be reconciled with Nehemiah chapter 5 and 12, which states that Nehemiah was governor for 12 years, whereas the period of rebuilding was only 52 days. It may be that the answer is that the 52 days refers to the time between Nehemiah chapter 6 verse 1, when the wall itself was complete, but the gates had not been installed, and verse 15, when the project was finally completed and the gates were in place. If that is the case, then the overall rebuilding work took much longer than 52 days, perhaps many years. In merely human terms, that seems much more likely, given the terrible state of disrepair that the walls were in. But neither does it diminish the remarkable achievement of Nehemiah and his fellow Jews. If we accept this longer period, they were engaged in a marathon rather than a sprint, yet they maintained their enthusiasm and their commitment throughout that period, despite the continuing hostility of their enemies. So on completing the work, Nehemiah gives the charge of the city into the hands of his brother Hanani, and Hanani, the leader of the citadel. Hanani was the man who had travelled to Shushan to bring Nehemiah the news of the desolations of Jerusalem. His credentials as a man with a passionate concern for the welfare of the city were therefore long established. Hanani is appointed as joint ruler. His qualification was that he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Not a bad description, I'm sure you'll agree. In this context, it is interesting to note that in the list of construction workers recorded in Nehemiah 3, we get two separate references to leaders of half the district of Jerusalem, Rephaiah in verse 9 and Shallum in verse 12. It would therefore seem that the duties of the leaders of the half-district of Jerusalem were now given to Hananiah and Hananiah. That means that Rephaiah and Shallum had passed off the scene, adding credence to the possibility of the longer period of construction of which we spoke of a moment or two ago. Nehemiah gives these two new rulers instructions concerning the continuing defence of the city. Verse 3 of chapter 7. Do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. While they stand guard, let them shut and bar the doors. And appoint guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, one at his watch station and another in front of his own house. Here we see that although the Samaritan opposition was disheartened, they had not given up. The threat still remained. But to conclude tonight's study, we're going to skip over a few chapters and pick up the narrative again with the dedication of the wall. We will return to consider the intervening chapters in the final address in this series, God willing. So we want to go over to chapter 12 and verse 27. Now at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgiving and singing, with cymbals and stringed instruments and harps. And the sons of the singers gathered together from the countryside around Jerusalem, from the villages of the Netophathites, from the house of Gilgal, from the fields of Geba and Azmaveth, for the singers had built themselves villages all around Jerusalem. The first task then was to summon all the Levites and singers from every part of the land. Although the occasion was to celebrate the rebuilding of Jerusalem, the rejoicing was to be national rather than parochial. The villages of the Netophathites, the fields of Geba and Azmaveth, were all near Bethlehem, for these places are linked by a list of Levitical towns recorded in Nehemiah 7. But having assembled all the temple servants, they prepared themselves for the dedication ceremony. And so we read in verse 30 of chapter 12, the priests and the Levites purified themselves, and purified the people, and the gates, and the wall. And surely the order here is very important. First, the religious leaders purified themselves. Only then were they in a position to purify the people. And it would be hypocrisy to dedicate the city walls unless the people inside those walls had already dedicated themselves. So having prepared the hearts and minds of the people, the community were now ready to give praise and thanks to God. And so Nehemiah organises two processional groups to circumnavigate the wall, as described in verse 31. Then I brought up the princes of Judah upon the wall, and appointed two great companies of them that gave thanks, whereof one went on the right hand upon the wall toward the dung gate. And if we read on through the chapter, we see that this choir went on past the dung gate, continued to the water gate, and completed a walk along the southern half of the wall, travelling in a counterclockwise direction. And as verse 38 explains, the other thanksgiving choir went the opposite way, going past the Tower of the Ovens as far as the broad wall, and above the gate of Ephraim, above the old gate, above the fish gate, the Tower of Hananel, the Tower of the Hundred, as far as the sheep gate, and they stopped by the gate of the prison. This choir then followed the route of the northern half of the wall in a clockwise direction. Tobiah the Ammonite had predicted whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. But it wasn't a fox that had gone up on the wall, it was two large thanksgiving choirs, and the wall didn't budge an inch. Nehemiah and his fellow builders had the last laugh. Well, we can only speculate as to the songs of praise that were voiced on that occasion. But it has been suggested that Psalm 48 will be particularly appropriate. We can imagine verses 12 to 14 of that psalm being sung as they walk round the walls. Walk about Zion, go all around her, count her towers, mark well her bulwarks, consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. For this is God, our God, forever and ever. He will be our guide, even to death. As the two choirs continued their separate circuits of the wall, eventually they met in the vicinity of the temple. And so verse 40 of chapter 12 of Nehemiah says, the two thanksgiving choirs stood in the house of God. So as the two choirs merged as one in the temple courts, we can imagine them singing some other verses from that same Psalm 48. God is in her Zion's citadels. He has shown himself to be her fortress. As we have heard, so we have seen in the city of the Lord Almighty, in the city of our God. God makes her secure forever. Within your temple, O God, we meditate on your unfailing love. And this great rejoicing described in Nehemiah chapter 12 is surely a fitting tribute to the work that Nehemiah had encouraged his countrymen to achieve. Verse 43 tells us that that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced. But God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off. Those who heard afar off included Sanballat and his cronies, who were still plotting and scheming, as we shall see next time. But for the Jews, Jerusalem was at last a place of joy and rejoicing. To quote Psalm 48 again, great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in his holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is in her palaces. He is known as her refuge. As well as reflecting the feelings of the returned exiles, this psalm obviously looks forward to a time of even greater celebration. So in a few moments, when we sing our concluding hymn of praise, perhaps we should try and imagine being part of one of those two choirs walking along the completed walls of the city. And we can also look forward to the day when the name of that city will be Jehovah Shammah, the Lord is there.